warm welcome. Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming on this on a Sunday sunny day, which is much less sunny for us when we know what is going on right now. Shelling of Gaza, rockets launched at Israeli communities on the other side of the border. And this makes my job today, in a way, very relevant, but also much harder, because I was asked to speak in general about the children of Gaza. And this is a subject very, very different from the other subjects I talked about. I mean, the theme, though we are talking about the same, of course, the same people and the same reality of Israeli domination over Palestinians. But when you suggested this title of children, it brought at the same time a smile on my face, because I could imagine all those children, all these Gazan children that I have known over the years. And then tremendous sadness, because first of all, I am deprived of entering Gaza. I'm not allowed, like all the other Israeli journalists. We, since 2006, we are not allowed to enter Gaza. I did enter Gaza three times afterwards, so-called illegally, so not with an Israeli permit. And I managed to do this. But it's since 2010 that I haven't been to Gaza. And the journalist that I am, I need things which are very concrete in order to describe. I mean, you ask me about children. So, you know, I don't want to tell you statistics about Palestinian children. This you can read in books. Reports of the World Bank, for example, that there are the number of children until the age of 15, that 45 or so percent of the Palestinian, of the Gazan population are children below 15 and below. And about 60% of kids in working age between 15 to 24 or 25 are unemployed. So all these statistics you can find. I'm not here for giving you statistics. I'm here to talk about the children, and I want to talk about children that I know, not that I imagine. A while ago, I had two things that happened, and you understand why I'm smiling. I got an email by someone who lives now in Amman, in Jordan. I knew him when he was a child, and he reminded me how I played with them, how I had all kinds of tricks, you know, played with children. He's the son of good friends of mine. I got this note, and then I got a note from his cousin, who also mentioned how I used to play with them. And we met in Berlin with this cousin. He's a handsome, tall guy. You know, I had to walk to look at him like this while I remembered him so small. And he also remembered the tricks and the plays that I used to play with them and throwing them to the air and all sorts of things that you do with children when you love children. And I remembered how both of them, during the Second Intifada, and I went to demonstrations that occurred, and the kids asked me, are you going to throw stones at the military position? Because there were demonstrations towards a position, military position, that was protecting a settlement. And people were throwing stones, a kind of symbolic manner. The position is is armored, is protected, you cannot harm it. But then the demonstrators were shot at from helicopters. By then it was not yet, the drones were not yet developed, the shooting instrument or device. So helicopters were shooting at people. It was quite frightening. But the people went there as a demonstration, mass demonstrations, and some were throwing stones. And the kids asked me, are you going to throw stones? And I said, unfortunately not, because I'm a journalist. So I only, I'm going to write. But I must tell you that poetically, I did feel I want to throw a stone, a symbolic stone, at this symbol of very, very ugly, violent symbol of Israeli occupation. These two kids, Azat and Bashar, have managed to live. And they prosper outside. They have jobs, they have a place to live, they have freedom of movement. I think they are already in the way of European citizenship or in one of the countries. They left because having stayed in Gaza would have not allowed them to ever to develop themselves. So they left in early enough. They miss Gaza. If Gaza were not a huge prison, they would have stayed in Gaza, or they would have returned every now and then. Bashar, his parents are in Gaza. He cannot see them, or he sees them very rarely, if there is a very rare chance that they leave. But they found their solution, which is a solution of a lot of torment. To live outside and so far away. And many of the other kids that I remember, again, having played with them and followed their life as children, life of children who go to school and don't like to go to school and go study and don't like to study and do study and take music and go to dabke lessons and fighting with the quarreling with the parents, you know, kids, children. So many of them have managed to go and live abroad, and for years already. But this is the minority. How many can arrange this solution for themselves? So I think about all the others too that I don't have contact with. One of the tricks that I used to play with children is some movements with my hands. Like I can pretend that I'm cutting my finger. You know, it's a trick with children. And children are really, at first they are really, amazed how I do it. And then I show them the trick. And this is something I used to play with children in very traumatic places when I did go to Gaza, also in the West Bank, of course, but in Gaza, for example, in Rafah, I remember in 2004, there was an Israeli invasion for several days and a curfew over the refugee camp in a large neighborhood in Rafah, when the Israeli army demolished many houses. And kids with their families, found shelter in UNRWA schools, in some schools. And I would go to the schools to collect testimonies of families and children about the Israeli army and about the demolition. And to break the ice with the children, who were, of course, terrorized, I used to play, the five tricks that I know with children. And one of them I remember, and now preparing for the, I thought about him. A huge Israeli bulldozer came up to their house to demolish it. It was done so in order to find tunnels that were built between the Palestinian side of Gaza to the Egyptian side of Gaza, of Rafah city. And a huge, huge bulldozer, military armored bulldozer, approached the house while the family was in or almost getting out. And over a night, that's what his mother told me, over the night or over a few minutes or a few hours, he got white hair. He was, I think if I remember correctly, around 8 to 9 years old. Then I remember another child, a child of friends of mine in northern Gaza Strip, in Beit Hanun. They're also there that the soldiers took him as a human shield when they wanted to enter houses and look for explosives or militants. And they took him as human shield. And for years he suffered from a skin rash and completely traumatized. And then I wonder about all the other children that I know that have lived through three major wars and uncounted military invasions and attacks. And now, right now, live under this fear that any moment an Israeli bomb will fall on a nearby house, not on their house, but on a nearby house. I can imagine the terrifying noise of these bombs. I mean, I heard them too. And I ask myself, how do they sustain? How do they remain so normal? So my friends, Gazan friends, tell me, who tells you that we are normal? But I find this amazing strength, and at the same time, I know that people are affected. We know, according to UN figures, at least 300,000 children need some sort of psychological assistance, having been traumatized all over these years. It's hard to imagine 300,000 in a population of 2 million. But what about the parents? What about the fathers? What about the mothers? And can you really achieve anything of this psychological assistance or support or protection while the trauma in which you are, I mean, it's not post-trauma, it's a successive trauma. I really don't have the answer. Maybe Jihad can answer better than I, as being a Gazan. Whenever I have the chance to meet a Palestinian, a young Palestinian, and it is very rare going out of Gaza, I feel awe. I feel I'm full of admiration. 2 years ago, another child of my friends that I hadn't seen for 10 years, since 2009. He came in a group that was the first time allowed to go out of Gaza and to travel in the West Bank and to meet West Bankers, West Bank children. He himself is an oud player, extremely talented. His three brothers and sisters are outside, have left already, but he is the smallest. And they were dancing, and they were playing music, those children who came from Gaza. And just 2 years earlier, they went through this war. And they were smiling, and they were joking, and he told me things about Hamas with a lot of criticism, but at the same time, he was joking, and he was preparing for an exam, very prestigious, for a very prestigious American program. And I ask myself, where is the energy from? Where are the talents from? And I say to ourselves, because we think about Gazans in general, and Gazans in particular, and children in particular, and Palestinians in general, as the victims that deserve our mercy. And I plead us to say they are wronged. It's a people being wronged for very long, but the title of victim minimizes and limits our understanding of their strength. But when I don't talk about the military attacks and the bombing and the fear of being murdered and killed and wounded, when I don't talk about this, I talk about the prison that Gaza is. While the military situation, like today, is somehow political decision by both parties, both Hamas and Israeli army. The reality of prison, the reality in which Palestinians live in Gaza, which is prison or a huge detention camp, is a totally Israeli human-made reality. And reality that is the sole responsible for the disaster in which Gazans live, and that the UN said a disaster that will reach a point in 2020, according to the UN, a point where Gaza will not be anymore livable or habitable. The pollution of water, the pollution of overflowing of sewage, the contamination of the land, of the soil, how I cannot even imagine with what the soil of Gaza is absorbed after all the Israeli bombings. What kind of chemicals or metals have been absorbed there in the soil and in the water. Israel sprays the fields of Gazans. It claims that it sprays the fields outside of Gaza with chemicals, with herbicide. But twice a year, these herbicides enter into Gaza, and we know that it is in order to flatten the land, to make visibility for the Israel army. How all these things affect people and children. And the fact that children do not know what it is to go beyond 40 kilometer long, 15, 16 kilometer width of Gaza. Here again, one of the children that I know, she's already 21, 22. When she was 15 or 16, she had leukemia. And she came to be treated in Jerusalem. And the first thing she told me, you see what the wars do to me, because she concluded that the leukemia is because of the war. And we cannot refute her with all the knowledge that we know about the combination of traumas and chemicals and pollution, what they cause to the body. Her friends, and Gazans have this sense of humor, her friends told you, oh, you are so lucky you have cancer, you can go to Jerusalem. Now her young brother was never out of the west of Gaza. While people in the West Bank and children in the West Bank don't know what the sea is, in Gaza, the children do not know what a mountain is, because Gaza is a flat area. They do not know. I took her, Rima, the girl, we traveled a bit, we hiked a bit in the West Bank, and she had photos of the mountains and of some springs, and she sent it to her brother. And for him, it's like a science fiction wonder. The stream that goes out of a little of a rock, of a mountain. For him, it is he has to use a lot of imagination in order to understand how the land all of a sudden can curve up and curve down. And I think about the million children that I don't know, and all the deprivation that they go through because of being completely enclosed and not allowed to leave the Gaza Strip. This policy, this Israeli policy, and it's very important to remember that it is a policy, and it started as a political measure in 1991. It didn't start later. People usually attribute the policy of closure, of shutting Gaza and restricting Gazans' freedom of movement. People associate it either with the suicide attacks that started in 1994 or with the advent of Hamas in 2006. This is fabrication. This is not true. The policy of restricting Gazans from freedom of movement started in 91. It is then that Israel issued a pass system very similar to that of the apartheid South Africa. That Palestinians, until then, Palestinians had a certain freedom of movement within the country, and they could go between Gaza and the West Bank, and from Gaza to Israel, and from West Bank to Israel, without permits, without intervention. The exception of those Palestinians was not allowed freedom of movement on political and security reasons. But the rule was that people's right for freedom of movement is respected, including children. And by the way, many children went to Israel to work and started helping their families very early on when they were 14 and 13. They went to Israeli markets and worked there, and to Israeli restaurants and washed the dishes there, and contributed greatly to the economical sustainability of their families. This is another admirable aspect of Palestinian children back then. And many financed that, in that way they financed their studies later on. But Israel, at the eve of the negotiations with Israel, with the Palestinians, first in Madrid and later on in Oslo, Israel changed its policy and decided that Palestinians have to ask, have to have a personal permit in order to leave each area, either the West Bank or the Gaza Strip. By this, Israel separated Gaza from the West Bank. This was the first step. And this runs contrary to a promise made at Oslo negotiations that both Gaza and the West Bank are one territorial unit, because they are going to constitute the future Palestinian state. And from 91, Israel just does the opposite. And with 93, when the Oslo negotiations started, it continued with this policy of separating Gaza from the West Bank, Gaza population from the West Bank. And you ask me why, and I'll tell you, because Israel... Because if this, the Palestinian state in Gaza and the West Bank, was seen by the world as a basic for the peaceful solution or peaceful settlement between the two sides, and that the Palestinians accepted, fully accepted, Israel did everything possible to foil this possibility of a Palestinian state in Gaza and the West Bank. And the first condition for this was to disconnect Gaza from the West Bank. The second condition for this was to actually replicate or duplicate Gaza in the West Bank, to create enclaves in the West Bank, Palestinian enclaves, separated from each other, engulfed by an Israeli-controlled territory, Israeli-controlled territory of settlements and military positions. So the reality today is that we have the enclave of Gaza and several enclaves, Palestinian enclaves, under limited Palestinian self-rule in the West Bank. It's not all the West Bank. It's only 39% of the West Bank. Areas that are disconnected from each other and that Israel can any moment shut down so that they cannot even move from one place to another, just like Gazans cannot move. So when you look at Palestinians and Palestinian children in the West Bank, I think to myself, sometimes when they look at their future, they see the future, they see it in Gaza. A future without freedom of movement, a future when the basic moves are being curtailed, a future where some foreign rule decides for you where you study, what you study, when you study, whether you are allowed to go to school, to university, because Gazan children are not allowed to go to study in the West Bank. It is an occupation without direct presence of soldiers, but it is an occupation that is very invasive, military occupation, very invasive, that goes into the details of people's lives, to the extent that people who are married cannot live together in the same place, if one is Gazan and one is not. Or that they are separated from their own children if one of the spouses is a Gazan and cannot go and live with the children in the West Bank. And the details are many. You know, it never ends. I can continue and continue. I think that the main demand has to be to lift indeed. To lift this blockade over Gaza. And this issue is not about Egypt, about the freedom of people to go outside from Gaza and to go to Egypt. First, they have to restore their right for freedom of movement outside of Gaza either to Israel, historical Palestine, and to the West Bank and abroad, through where it is the most is the easiest and the closest, not Rafah. And they have their ties are with the West Bank, not with the main ties, the immediate ties, the natural ties are within the country. Israel, historical Palestine, West Bank, whatever. And this has to be restored, including, of course, the economical restrictions and other things. Otherwise, indeed, Gaza will be totally inhabitable in 2 or 3 or 5 months. Thank you.
So my question is, on behalf of Jewish people who are struggling with this, and I even counted Jewish audiences outside Israel, and in Israel too, who sincerely want to take on what you're telling us, the stories, the actual suffering, but are torn because of their allegiance to Israel and their fear, their concern, reflected or unreflected, that by opening up to this, they are not being loyal to Israel. And being aware that rockets are coming in from Gaza into Israel right now, and Jewish lives are in jeopardy too.
My first answer would be that Palestinians and Israelis are not on a symmetrical stand. Palestinians have a right, and I think also an obligation, to resist Israeli foreign domination. Now, people may argue about the forms of resistance. People have questions about them. I have my doubts. I have my analysis over Hamas' use of rockets or of militarization. I also think that many Palestinians in Gaza do not think that this is the ultimate way to win. But it's not about two symmetrical powers that fight each other. Allegiance to Israel is already a strange thing for me. You know, there aren't many Jews who came to my talks, and certainly not from the more mainstream community. But they remind me, this allegiance to Israel reminds me of allegiance of communists to the Soviet Union. In their refusal to know the reality, in their refusal to face the information that flows and shows that this Soviet Union is not your dreamland. I know because I come from a communist family, and I know because I've witnessed my family, my parents struggling with the information. And while I totally still adhere to basics of the socialist and radical socialist ideologies, I also refuse to see the Soviet Union or any other so-called socialist state as a model for me. And I think that the Jews have to think about this comparison and to realize that Israel is not what they have thought about that Israel is or what Israel should be. Unfortunately, with the Oslo process, which I refuse to call peace process, with the Oslo process, Israel proved to itself and to the Israelis and to the Palestinians that it is the settler colonial entity that was always charged that it rejected for many years, but here it proves that it is. Because it was so simple to accept the generous Palestinian offer during Oslo and to establish a Palestinian state in Gaza and the West Bank without settlements, with Jerusalem as a capital. There was a leader that was respected, Palestinian leader that was respected by his people, Arafat, And he was ready for this. I would Israel did the opposite. Israel did everything to colonize further the West Bank, to decimate the space that is allocated to Palestinians, to fragment Palestinian community into several disconnected communities addressed as individuals and not as a people, not as a collective. It did what settler colonial entities and movements have done for 200, 300 years, and actually proved that 48 and the 30s, and it was that Zionism is a settler colonial movement. So we are in a problem. You are proving what everybody said, what people told about you, and you said that they are anti-Semites, but you are doing this. So I think that, my aim would be, yes, we should respect as Jews our history. We should never tire to remind people, including Palestinians, that that Zionism was not a movement of the majority. Until the late 20s, 1920s, and beginning of the 1930s, the majority of Jews opted for other solutions or other ways to evade or to escape persecution or to challenge persecution. And anti-Semitism and persecution of Jews is not a fairy tale that we tell you. It was real. It was real, but the majority of Jews prefer to remain in the diaspora and to find solutions in the diaspora. I take my parents. They saw the diaspora as their home. My mother is from Yugoslavia, my father is from Romania. These were their homes. But then, with the advent of Hitler to power in Nazi and in Germany, and the advent of Nazism, the diaspora gave another message to the Jews. Not only that they are second or third or fourth rate citizens, not only that they are not wanted among these countries, but they are not wanted in this world. And this was a strong message, and it is not, it is not something that I will ask you, especially when I'm asking this always from Palestinians and Palestinian friends of mine. We should not belittle this. And that's why, and I'm sure that if United States and Canada had opened their gates to Jewish emigration in the 30s and the 40s, not just, some select celebrities like Einstein or I don't know what, or Hannah Arendt, but the masses, the proletariat, the poor people, if they had accepted them all, they wouldn't have come to Palestine. They would have been saved, many of them would have been saved, and they wouldn't have emigrated to Palestine. But at the same time, so Jews came, and it's at the expense of Palestinians. So if we really wanted a refuge, and if we really wanted to build a model society, first of all, we would have accepted the Palestinians back, those who were expelled or ran away or were not in the country in 1948. We would have looked. I know it is today it sounds completely hypothetical, but we had several opportunities over the years to build another course, and not to remain a foreign entity, foreign European entity within an Arab world. We decide to be so, and for this we have to permanently rely on the military strength. Expand this military strength, and then export it to the world, and then export it to murderous regimes all over the world for profit. This is Israel. And I don't think that this is something that I would, that I feel solidarity with this, the need of Jews to have allegiance to this kind of Israel.
We are told that Israel today, and we now know that it is genocidal, murderous, and we're also told that today in Israel, the people are more religious than they ever have been in the past. Do their crimes, does their malice against Palestinians have any foundation in their religion?
Shall we collect some in, yeah?
So I was wondering what movement there is among journalists for to demand journalistic freedom and how we can support that.
My question is, you had mentioned about children who are being separated in the Gaza Strip.
From my observation and analysis over the last 30 years, I allow myself to say that the term genocidal, when it comes to Israeli policies, is not reflecting the reality. It reflects maybe a political position of people and tendencies, and I don't like to give scores or to create hierarchy in suffering. The aim of Israeli policies is not genocide. I don't know if the aim of the people who or the movements which established America and United States, if the aim was genocidal, but the result was to a large extent, as our friend here says, was genocidal. But the Palestinians have not been and are not decimated the way the indigenous people here were decimated. So to say genocide about Israeli policies is inaccurate. Now, it doesn't mean that it is a way, I mean, there has been created some sort of hierarchy, and very much to the blame of Israel, the way it manipulates and merchandises the Holocaust, that puts things in suffering and atrocities in hierarchy. And if you don't reach the top, what was claimed to be the top of the German Nazi industry of murder, then, okay, all the rest is okay. Nonsense, of course not. Personally, as a child of survivors, I come to think very often, aren't 300, 400 years of slavery not a much worse Holocaust than what my people has been through? It was, you know, it was for 5 years, 6 years, and it ended. The whole world was again, I mean, the many countries joined in and fought against the Nazi Germany. But with American African slaves, how long it took, and all the remnants till today. So I'm asking myself, without being like the genocide of the Jews in Europe, I often feel that this is again, I don't like to make to put hierarchies. But I think that there is something much and that also relates to many more people and through so many centuries. But I say it because we have to be accurate about the definitions and the descriptions we give. Because if we use wrong descriptions or words, we deviate the discussion to other areas. Would you say genocidal about Syria? Would you say genocidal about Iraq, Saddam Hussein? Sometimes I feel that in the camps that criticize Israel, critics hesitant to use the term genocide or the suffix side. It's sociocide, it's memocide, much more easily, and I think it is for political reasons. Because it is difficult to accept that there is some connection, that Zionism as a settler colonial movement is not, its success is not a linearistic success that comes out from a plot and then it succeeded, but it also, what intervenes in between is this history of genocide against the Jewish people in Europe. The purpose of Israeli policies is to fragment Palestinian society, is to dissuade it from or block its demands for freedom, for liberation, for the right of return, for Masirat Takrir, I keep forgetting, a right of self-determination. This is the Israeli aim. It is not about murdering the entire Palestinian, the Palestinian people. And you see, Gaza 20 years ago was around 1,200,000 people. It's 2 million today, with all the wars and everything. So the means, of course, bring realities to unbearable levels. And unbearable doesn't have to be a concentration camp like Auschwitz or Bergen-Belsen, where my mother was. No. Unbearable is that a child cannot travel and cannot have clean water and cannot play and cannot study. This is unbearable. Why do we have to put as a standard the worst periods in human history, and certainly not only the worst periods in Europe? Now, the religious people in Israel, the Orthodox Jews, there are more today than before. One of the reasons is they have more children than secular families, than secular people. Now, I will ask you, does the Inquisition, the history of Inquisition, and the history of Christian European invasions to Canada and United States and South America tell you that Christianity is genocidal? You ask me if Judaism is genocidal because of what you interpret wrongly about Israel. But the Christian history is so bloody, so bloody. Now, do I say that this is the Christianity, or do I say that there are forces, historical forces, movements, people who profited, people who benefited, and took from Christianity what they wanted to take and used it the way they wanted to use? Well, you have a liberation movement among Christian Catholics in the South America, which is a model for emancipatory religious figures. They are not the same. And the same with Islam. So to condemn a whole religion as genocidal rings many alarms in my head. Many, many alarms. Fake news and journalism. Yes, it is. You know, like, I've been struggling with fake news before this term became so fashionable. Because the whole, you know, like the way that the Israeli mainstream media portrayed the reality was always untrue, was always missing, was always omitting, was always describing things in a distorted way. So for me, it is not new, and that's why I find it difficult to answer. What do you do? You give. You continue and give the facts. I know, but I know that it's very difficult when all of a sudden you have, I want to think about an example about things that I cover. Ah, okay. In the West Bank, there is a right-wing NGO called for the NGO to protect the nation's land. And they are monitoring any Palestinian move in the West Bank, but also in the Negev, in Israel proper, where Palestinians build, live, and where sometimes, when they have to build without Israeli permits, because Israel does not give them the permits. And then mainstream media takes this fake information it's real information with fake analysis of it. And they say, Palestinians get control over Israeli land. A, it's Palestinian land, occupied land. I don't care if it's private or state land or whatever, public land. For me, it's the same. I'm against private property. But so it is, I don't care if it is. But they live there, and they build, and it's their place. And they build without a permit because they don't get a permit. And nearby, there is a settlement that builds with a permit or without a permit and only expands. And any American Jew who is here now can any moment go there and live there and have more rights than a Palestinian who was born and lives nearby. So, yes, it's difficult because you hear the news. You hear an encore in a radio station and then a TV program talking about those Palestinians who, a'udhu billah, get control over the land. And it's their land. So where do you start? Where do you start? Do you relate to them? So I'm asking myself, do I have to report about this group or not? What do I report? What do I not report? So I agree that this is, you don't have one answer for all. It depends on the sort of the fake news. But again, it is of course, you know, I could say that our weapon, if I may use this term, is to be very accurate. We don't need to exaggerate. We don't need to hide. We don't need to camouflage. Because they rely so much on fake news or distorted facts, we have to learn to be very accurate. Okay, so there's one more. Yeah. First of all, let me stress it. There is no issue here of mixed blood. It's all Palestinians. On the contrary, it's all Palestinians. I don't know about blood at all, how mixed it can be, but we're talking about Palestinians. And for these geopolitical reasons, there are families who have to be separated because Israel does not allow one to live in the other place, etc. And kids are... It is not the rule, it is not the majority, but it certainly is... It attests to the policies that this is not considered, the right of a family to live together is not considered by Israel a human right basic. And this is the thing. Even if it is 10 families, actually it's many more, but of all sorts, it's tens of thousands of families that Israel does not acknowledge their right to live together in the place they choose, because Israel manipulates with Palestinian demography. So if you have couples in the West Bank that are, one spouse is Palestinian and the other is an American citizen, Israel will not enable the American citizen to remain and live in their own home in Palestine normally. This person will have to go and come back and plead and maybe pay bonds for getting back to the country. They will have to extend their visas every now and then, as if they are tourists in their own home. So it's many examples that I can only summarize and say, Israel does not acknowledge family life as a basic human right that it has to respect. And it's very interesting to remember, because the Jewish the Jews in America led a very long struggle in favor of the Soviet Union Jews when they wanted to emigrate. So the demand was for them not just to emigrate, but to unite with their families in Israel. And this same Jewish community does not see the parallels and actually shows that how hypocritic it is, that this very basic demand is only valid for Jews and not for Palestinians. For the valid demand for the right of families to choose where they live and to live together.
So we will take one last question.
Hi, I'm just going to say that I'm very confused on your stance on Palestine, because at your event at Northwestern earlier this week, you complained that Palestinians uninvited you from a conference that was meant to be for Palestinians. And you said Palestinian men control every aspect of Palestinian women's lives. And you said that the stories of life before 1948 are fantasy stories. But today you're saying very true experiences of kids in Gaza. So what is your stance on Palestine? And also, there is genocide going on in Palestine. And not only to Palestinians, but also to the Ethiopian Jewish women who are just experiencing disgusting forms of imprisonment.
I'm very sorry that you are confused, because it means that it's hard for you to take a position that is not, how would I say gently, No, a position that is more multi-layered, or facts that are more multi-layered. You got it wrong also about the conference. I never said it. About the conference, I said something else. Maybe you took the conference from some position paper. I don't know. I was kicked out of a conference in Birzeit, that's true. But I don't think that I spoke about it in Evanston. Or if you read my stuff, if you read my articles, you would have been less confused. But I think, I'm afraid you come here in order to show confusion and to doubt a thing that are said by a Jewish-Israeli journalist. That's my impression. I'm very sorry. History is not linear. History is not... History does not perform what ideologies dictate. And I try to describe this more troubled sides and conflicting parts. So there is no way to be confused. I really, there is a way to appreciate that we live in contradictions too. But the position that you are against, that you want to change reality, to change it for the better, that you support struggles, you support liberation struggles, it shouldn't force me to negate the history of my people. And I'm sorry because I thought you alluded to another conference, to another meeting. Yes, I was very frank when I meet. You know, I have a tendency when I speak to an audience, to a certain audience, I will tell this certain audience what they do not necessarily want to hear. I will not recite to all of you the same narrative of a radical Israeli Jew who is opposing Israeli apartheid system and Israeli settler colonialism. With the Arab and Palestinian, predominantly Palestinian audience, I shared things that I don't share in public, in other publics. Why to be confused? I'm appealing to your intellect. I'm appealing to your integrity by using the subjects I'm talking about in different audiences. Nothing to be confused about. I'm the same Amira and the same person who is against the all what I said I am. And I say that Israel control, I don't know, I mean, yeah, Israel control every aspect of Palestinian life in general, but I also spoke about the self-rule enclaves where Palestinians live and prefer to remain and live now and not to revolt now against it because they are afraid the situation will get worse. Now, as for genocide, you know, like you cannot, I'm coming from the country, I don't know, and Ethiopian women don't go. There were experiments and things, but it is not genocide of the Ethiopian women. There is terrible discrimination. At the same time, Ethiopian women go to the army and go to checkpoints and go with the army to checkpoints and to Palestinian homes, and they go to universities. And they fight for, they go on demonstrations against the Israeli police. It's not genocide. Don't, you know, you cheapen the term of genocide. You cheapen it. You said a genocide. You said genocide. There is no ethnic cleansing of Ethiopian women. There was sterilization and it was found out sterilization and indeed polling. But it's not, you know, there were experiments. It's not the rule, and it was found out, and it is fought against, and there is discrimination, and appalling, and racist attitudes that are indeed baffling even, because it's Israel which attracted or called the Ethiopian Jews to come to the country. Thank you.